Hooker Chemical Corporation dumped over 80 toxic substances at Love Connect.
The $53 million she stole from the city of Dixon, Illinois,
orchestrating the largest lotto scam ever.
White collar and corporate crime is a worldwide epidemic. From simple embezzlements, frauds, con artists, and Ponzi schemes, to devastating environmental disasters and economic depressions, these financially motivated crimes have shaped our world in unimaginable ways, all in the name of greed. Swindled is a podcast that uses narrative storytelling, archival audio, and immersive soundscapes to explore these true cases of white-collar and corporate crime. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever else you may get your podcasts. For more information about the show, visit our website at swindledpodcast.com and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Swindled Podcast.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Imagine that you are told the police are looking for you, that they have warrants. You know you've done nothing wrong, and you want to do the right thing. You want to get ahead of this. Avoid being put in cuffs. So you go to the police station and tell them you hear they're looking for you. You wait nervously for the detective assigned to your case. He tells you you're in big trouble, but won't say what you did. You plead with him. You want to clear your name. You even offer to take a lie detector test. The detective refuses. He tells you you better be quiet, because everything you say can be used against you in court. They still haven't even told you what you've done. Your nightmare is just beginning. Because you didn't do it. You have an alibi. There's no physical evidence tying you to the scene. It doesn't matter. You are a minority accused of a very serious crime. Welcome to episode 15, The Wrongful Conviction of Willie Grimes. In honor of Black History Month, I wanted to take a look at one of the most famous cases of wrongful conviction in the U.S., an African-American man arrested due to cross-racial identification bias, who was then convicted due to racism, misconduct, and good old-fashioned tunnel vision. At around 9 p.m. on October 24, 1987, in Hickory, North Carolina, 69-year-old Carrie Elliott had just taken her blood pressure pills, laid out her church clothes for the next morning, and was getting ready for bed. She had been clipping coupons on the couch when she heard a knock at the door. The 5-foot-tall white woman weighed less than 100 pounds, and she was already nervous about the neighborhood she lived in. Little Berlin was a few small duplexes near I-40, an hour west of Charlotte. Carrie Elliott was considered too old for public housing, and she had lived there for the last 2 years and hated the place. It was even worse now that her husband had died. He had passed away less than a year ago, and without him there, she rarely left her small apartment. She hesitated to open the door. The only visitors she ever had were her son and daughter-in-law, who would have called first, and her next-door neighbor, Linda McDowell. She was so nervous she wouldn't even let Linda's husband, Mason, inside her apartment. But she thought maybe Linda was checking in on her, so she opened the inside door slowly, peering through the screen door. She was immediately alarmed to see a 6-foot-tall black man she didn't know standing there. She quickly tried to shut the door, but he burst through. He brandished a switchblade and quickly shoved her onto the couch. He raped her there and then drug her to the bedroom, raping her again on top of her church clothes. She didn't scream, and when it was over, she told him she needed to go to the bathroom. He got up and announced that he was hungry. He went to the kitchen, asking her what she had in the refrigerator. She walked to the kitchen and told him her neighbors would be over soon and that he should leave. He said, "Mason? I saw Mason leave. Their apartment's empty. There's no one to help you." Carrie was shocked to hear Mason's name and wondered if they were friends. He took an apple and a bunch of bananas and let the door slam on his way out without another word. Carrie was too shaken to remember the number to call for police, so she called her son and daughter-in-law, who called the police before they rushed over. The police arrived less than 20 minutes after the attack. She described her attacker as a black man, about 6 feet tall, 200 to 225 pounds, about 35 years old, dark-skinned, and with an afro. She said he was wearing a green shirt, but that he took it off during the assaults. Carrie was taken to Catawba Memorial Hospital, where she was examined, photographed, and a rape kit was done. She was released with her relatives by 1 a.m. The police searched Carrie's apartment and yard. They collected several hairs from her bed and took the fruit from the bowl in her kitchen. 2 banana peels were seen outside her back door by Detective Steve Hunt, but he didn't collect them. He did, however, go pick up an apple core from the street, but later threw it away at the police station. The next day, Sergeant Steve Bryant showed Carrie a photo lineup that included a photograph of Albert Lindsay Turner, who was known to police for committing assaults in the past in the area. Aside from having a long record, he was the right height and weight. At the time, Albert Turner did have an afro, but the police photo was old and showed him with his hair in cornrows. Carrie Elliott was unable to identify anyone. 2 days after the assault, Carrie was talking about her attack with her neighbor, Linda McDowell. Linda said she might know the identity of the rapist, but said she would only talk to the police. Carrie then called police and reported what McDowell had said. Also, for the first time, she said that her attacker had a mole or bump on the side of his face and that she may have scratched him because she broke a fingernail. This was a detail she had not remembered at the time. What Carrie didn't know was that Linda McDowell was a police informant. Specifically, she was an informant for Sergeant Steve Bryant, one of the investigating officers who questioned Carrie the night of the attack. That same day, McDowell called the police station and asked if there was a reward in the Elliott rape case. They told her yes. Crime Stoppers was offering $1,000. She then reported that she knew a man named Willie Grimes who fit the description. She also said she had seen him around Little Berlin that evening, wearing a green shirt. She specifically said he had a mole on his face. Sergeant Steve Bryant then went back to Carrie Elliott and showed her a photo lineup that included Grimes. His photograph was in position 2, right where Albert Turner's photo had been. Carrie Elliott chose the photo of Willie Grimes, though she said she thought he had longer hair. He also didn't match her original description and stature, weighing 165 pounds and standing 6'2". Her original description had been a 6-foot tall man weighing over 200 pounds. This did not match the tall, lean physique of Willie Grimes. Nor did Mr. Grimes have an afro, a point she had been certain of in all descriptions. He did, however, have the mole she had later remembered, but it's obvious now that Linda McDowell planted that seed in her mind. What she also did not remember was her attacker having any major scars that would be noticeable. Willie Grimes has a prominent scar on his collarbone, which she would have seen as she said her attacker took his shirt off. He is also missing the tips of 3 fingers. Carrie Elliott also did not remember this detail at the time of the attack or later in court. Fingerprints had been taken from inside the apartment and also from a banana left in the fruit bowl. These prints did not match Willie Grimes, and they were never tested against Carrie's own fingerprints. But based on Carrie's shaky identification and Linda McDowell's tip, Warrants were sworn out for Willie Grimes' arrest. Willie Grimes had spent the evening of October 24th at a friend's house. Her name was Rachel Wilson. His girlfriend, Brenda Smith, had dropped him off on her way to work because he didn't drive. Willie had two prior DUIs, but other than that, his record was clean, and he certainly didn't have a history of violence. He spent the evening drinking and playing cards with Rachel and seven other friends, waiting for Brenda to get off work. She picked him up that morning right after her overnight shift, and they spent the rest of the weekend together. Willie went to work as usual on Monday, and on Tuesday morning, when he saw Brenda again, as the two worked separate shifts, she told him that the police had been looking for him. Willie had Brenda drive him straight over to the police station. He wasn't worried. He knew he hadn't done anything wrong. He told the officer at the front desk who he was and that he had been told the police were looking for him. He then waited patiently until finally Detective Steve Hunt came striding down the hall. Willie asked Detective Hunt why he was looking for him, but the detective just told him that he was in big trouble. Willie insisted he had done nothing wrong. After his DUIs, which were a few years prior, he had stayed out of trouble. He chose not to drive. He swore to Detective Hunt that he hadn't done anything and would take a lie detector test to prove it. Detective Hunt told Willie to stop talking and that anything he could say would be used against him in court. He then had him booked and fingerprinted, and then Willie found out why. He was charged with 2 counts of rape and 1 count of kidnapping. He was never even formally questioned. In the meantime, Rachel and the seven friends who were with him that night all gave sworn depositions. He had an alibi. Brenda Smith also gave a deposition insisting that after she picked Willie up, they had slept together and she had not seen any scratches or other indications he had been involved in an assault. It didn't matter. The police had their man. Even if Carrie Elliott's ID had been shaky, they still had Linda McDowell claiming to have seen him in the area. Willie Grimes knew he would never be able to raise bond, so he sat in jail, patiently waiting his day in court, keeping faith that once they were in court, there was no way the trial would be able to be continued because the victim wouldn't be able to identify him. But it wasn't that simple. I'd like to thank our sponsor, HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers amazing recipes with pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. HelloFresh offers a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly and are delivered right to your front door in recyclable, insulated packaging. And you will feel confident stepping into the kitchen with the HelloFresh simple recipes outlined on step-by-step cards with pictures. Cooking has never been so easy. Since starting this podcast, I have less time for meal planning, much less cooking, and HelloFresh has been a lifesaver. Most recipes only take around 30 minutes to prepare, and I can also count on dinner being delicious without breaking the bank, as they cost less than $10 a meal. My favorite recipe this week is the Presto Pesto Panko Chicken with roasted potatoes and a green salad. As nutritious as it is tasty, this meal was only 630 calories. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter code SOUTHFRIED30. Again, that's HelloFresh.com, discount code SOUTHFRIED30 to try your first week with HelloFresh. You won't regret it. And now, back to the show. In July of 1988, the first day of trial, small and frail, 69-year-old Carrie Elliott took the stand. Assistant District Attorney Bill Johnson began questioning her about the night of the attack. Carrie was able to recall the horrible night fairly vividly, and her testimony did not sound uncertain. Johnson asked her if she recognized her attacker, and she said yes, that she had seen him at the probable cause hearing and that the police had shown her a photograph of him. At this point, Willie Grimes' defense attorney, Ed DeTorres, objected. Johnson called for a sidebar and asked the judge if the jury could be removed while they considered this evidence, and the judge agreed. Without the jury in the room, the DA showed Carrie the same police photo array and asked her if she recognized it. She said, "No, sir." He said, "But you say you identified your attacker from here. Do you recognize any of the pictures as the one you identified?" Carrie replied, "I saw one that looked like it." He held the photograph up to the judge and said there were 6 pictures, each with a number under it. And then he asked Carrie which number photograph looked like her attacker. Instead of answering him, she said, "That looks like him over there." Johnson again asked her if any of the pictures looked like the man who attacked her, and she said that they had also been arranged in little blocks like that, meaning how the photo array had been arranged. He said, "Are you able to tell us whether any of these is the one you identified?" Carrie Elliott replied, quote, "Hard to tell any difference." Johnson, knowing that this photo identification was not helping his case, moved on. He asked her how certain she was that she identified the right man. She said that she was positive. He asked her if the man was in the courtroom, and she said yes, right down there beside the guy in the red shirt. Willie Grimes was not wearing his prison orange jumpsuit for court. He was wearing a red button-down shirt. Carrie Elliott had just identified his defense attorney, Ed DeTorres, as her attacker in open court. The trial of Willie Grimes lasted for 4 days. Even though his attorney was able to get the photo ID thrown out of evidence, even though Carrie Elliott picked the wrong man in court, even though he called 8 alibi witnesses and Willie's girlfriend as a character witness, and even though there was not one shred of physical evidence tying Willie Grimes to the scene, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to life in prison, plus 9 years for the kidnapping charge. Though many factors could be pointed to in the trial that allowed this to happen, perhaps the most egregious is the expert testimony of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab technician, Special Agent Troy Hamlin. And this point really stung, because it had been Willie Grimes himself who insisted on the testing. Agent Hamlin testified that the hair found on Carrie Elliott's bed was consistent with a negroid hair. The term negroid is still sometimes used in forensic science and in medical context, though many scholars have recommended that the term be avoided in scientific writings because of its association with scientific racism. But more importantly, the word conjures the more antiquated use of the word Negro, which finally fell out of favor during the Civil Rights Movement when African Americans pushed for the use of the word Black instead. It would likely be more inflammatory if used in trial today, but there is no denying the power of the word in the late 1980s. In a later investigation that we'll get to in just a minute, it was found that Agent Hamlin had originally only said that the hair was consistent with a negroid hair. After being pushed by Detective Steve Hunt, he wrote in his report that the hair could be consistent with the hair of Willie Grimes. We talked a little bit about junk science in my previous episode in relation to fibers. But hair evidence has largely been even more discredited than fiber because it's typically determined visually. Unless the root is attached for a DNA comparison, it's only the word of the technician of whether or not it is a match. At least fibers can be tested for their chemical makeup. And speaking of DNA, why was the rape kit not tested against Willie Grimes' DNA? DNA was first introduced to American courts in 1987. In 1988, during Willie's trial, it was still not commonly used, as the science was considered to be in its infancy. It wouldn't be until the 1995 trial of O.J. Simpson that the average American would grow used to hearing about DNA testimony. I would also like to remind you about the North Carolina lab scandal. I talked about that back in episode 4, Third Time's the Charm. In that episode, I actually defended the evidence because the DNA lab was not involved in the scandal. But the Hare and Trace evidence lab was. The FBI's investigation into the lab found serious issues with lab reporting practices over a 16-year period, from 1987 to 2003. And Willie Grimes' case would have definitely suffered from this scandal. But the scandal and investigation were not until 2009. During all that time, Willie Grimes had persevered in prison. He had declined all programs that might have granted him early release, particularly one in 1994 that was based in the therapy and rehabilitation of sexual offenders. Mr. Grimes repeatedly refused to participate in any such program. He said that to do so would be to admit that he had raped Carrie Elliott, and he would not lie, even if he died in prison. Mr. Grimes is a unique man with a cast-iron will. Many prisoners jumped on these programs in the 1990s, and I'm sure a great many were indeed guilty, but there were plenty of innocent men who participated just to get out of prison. It's difficult to blame them. No one knows what they would do in a situation like that. It's hard to understand the motivations, but personally, I relate more to the guys who went along with these programs just to get out. If I was facing life in prison, I'm sure I'd jump at the chance to get out. Principles be damned. Mr. Grimes would not. It's not that he was a saint, and it's not that he was without bitterness and sometimes despair. But over the years in prison, he became a religious man, and today says it was his faith in Jehovah that gave him the strength to never back down and admit wrongdoing. But he also is just not a liar, nor did he want to go through life branded a rapist. He would have had to register on the National Sex Offender Registry. Willie told NPR in August 2017, quote, "I would rather die before I would like to just get out of prison, because that would still have been on my name the rest of my life." But that doesn't mean he quit fighting. After the General Assembly enacted a post-conviction DNA testing statute in 2001, Willie fought for DNA testing. It was then that he found out that the physical evidence in his case had been destroyed. The rape kit was gone. The evidence was gone. In 2003, Willie's lawyer finally got his case on the desk of Christine Mumma, director of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence. She opened a file and began a long, daunting investigation. While she did, she was also helping to form a new commission. Established by North Carolina's General Assembly in 2006, the Innocence Inquiry Commission, or IIC, is an 8-member panel that investigates cases of actual innocence. The 8 members consist of a prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney, a sheriff, a superior court judge, a victim's right advocate, a member of the public, and 2 discretionary appointments. The commission evaluates the case and votes to submit to a special tribunal for review. If the 3-judge panel unanimously finds that the evidence for actual innocence is clear and convincing, the claimant is exonerated and immediately released. Because it is a state agency, the commission has powers that other institutions lack. Investigators can compel testimony with subpoenas and gather all kinds of evidence for their cases. Though Carrie Elliott's rape kit had been destroyed, the IIC still subpoenaed everything to do with Willie Grimes' case. Eventually, they got their hands on Detective Steve Hunt's personal file. The district attorney had denied ever having this evidence, and he wasn't lying. Hunt had never turned over the file. In it, they found the original photos used in the array shown to Carrie Elliott. Only on Willie Grimes' photo did they find that his name was written in reverse on the back. It would have been visible when shown to Carrie Elliott, and since it was the only one with writing, one could surmise that this was their only suspect. But this wasn't enough. They had to keep digging. Chris Mumma and now Kendra Montgomery of the IIC worked tirelessly. Finally, after a phone call with a clerk in Hickory, they caught a break. The clerk found the original fingerprint card from the fruit the attacker had touched. The prints did not match Willie Grimes, but they were finally put into APHIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System. This time, they hit a match. To one Albert Lindsay Turner, the original suspect. Albert Turner had been charged with assault on women 23 times over the years. He had served many years in jail, and he had indeed assaulted many women after Carrie Elliott's rape. Though there was no DNA to be tested against in Grimes' case, his DNA was entered into the North Carolina database and was connected to the sexual assault of a 12-year-old girl from back in 1973. But why was Albert Turner dropped as a suspect in the first place? The police originally liked him for this crime. He had a record, fit the description, and was in the original photo lineup, albeit with an older and misleading photo that Carrie Elliott couldn't identify. Could it be because Albert had a brother on the police force? That's right, his brother, Robert Turner, was an officer with the Hickory Police Department when the rape occurred. He also happened to be close friends with Detective Steve Hunt. Guess who else knew Albert Turner? That would be Linda McDowell. Remember when Carrie Elliott said that her attacker mentioned the name Mason, Linda's husband? That was not a coincidence. Albert Turner had actually been to the McDowell home on October 24, 1987, during the day. He was friends with the McDowells. It isn't explicitly said in any testimony given to the IIC, but it's possible she was not only intent on collecting reward money, but was shifting the blame away from her friend. Steve Hunt denied that his relationship to Robert Turner had anything to do with Willie Grimes' arrest. Given the fact that he held on to evidence and refused to question Grimes, it would look deliberate. But before he even knew about Willie Grimes, he had walked away from the damned banana peels at the crime scene. It could be he was just lazy and messy. And he had Sergeant Steve Bryant on his side, who was inclined to believe Linda McDowell as she was his informant. It could merely be a case of tunnel vision. Once they got a name, they forgot any other suspects and just wanted this case to be wrapped up. Considering how much the police rushed to close this case, it's somewhat fitting that on October 4th of 2012, the three-judge panel of the IIC took less than 30 minutes to decide that Willie Grimes was innocent after he had served more than 24 years in prison. Judge David Lee read the panel decision, dismissing all charges, and ordered that Willie Grimes' name be removed immediately from the sex offender registry. Then Lee paraphrased the Reverend Martin Luther King's famous 1963 speech and said, free at last, thank God Almighty, thank Jehovah, Willie Grimes is free at last. The current district attorney made no objection. Christina Muma, who had been fighting for Willie since 2003, was finally able to walk her client out as a free man. Racism has been pervasive in the United States criminal justice system throughout history. During the Jim Crow era, African Americans were legally barred from voter rolls in several southern states and were therefore barred from serving on juries. The jury in Willie Grimes' case was made up of 11 white jurors and only one African American. African Americans are only 13% of the American population, but represent the majority of innocent defendants wrongly convicted of crimes and later exonerated. They constitute 47% of the 1,900 exonerations listed in the National Registry of Exonerations as of October 2016. In the study, Race and Wrongful Convictions, by the National Registry of Exonerations, of those exonerated for sexual assault, black exonerees were sentenced to life in prison 28% of the time, while it was 17% for white exonerees. The average minimum term for African Americans was 29 years, and it was 19 years for whites. The same study pointed out that in the year 2000, 88% of sexual assault convictions in state courts were based on guilty pleas, and yet 96% of rape exonerees went to trial, meaning those that were innocent rarely plead guilty. They want their day in court. They try to believe in the justice system. The study also noted that, quote, black sexual assault defendants who insisted on their innocence and refused to plead guilty were punished more harshly for doing so than innocent white defendants who followed the same course. Black defendants, on average, received a term of 32 years to life, while their white counterparts averaged only 19 years. A black prisoner serving time for sexual assault is 3.5 times more likely to be innocent than a white sexual assault convict. The major cause for this disparity is the danger of mistaken eyewitness identification by white victims in violent crimes with black assailants. Assaults on white women by African American men are a small minority of all sexual assaults in the United States, but the study showed that they represent at least half of all misidentifications by eyewitnesses that led to exoneration. If you remember from her testimony, the elderly Carrie Elliott admitted that the pictures looked the same to her. She even pointed to Ed DeTorres, Willie Grimes' lawyer, in open court when asked to identify her attacker. This was not deliberate, and it was not malicious. Willie Grimes and his attorney both point out that the poor woman had suffered a brutal attack, and it was understandable that she would be confused. DeTorres tread lightly when cross-examining her on the stand because she did break down crying, finally saying, "If you had been through what I had been through." At which point, DeTorres dropped this line of questioning altogether. The motives of the police in this case are highly suspect, though it would seem that the two most innocent people were the victim and the defendant. Perhaps if Carrie Elliott had lived longer, she may have been more help in Willie's appeals in later years, especially once Albert Turner was connected to the case again. But she passed away in the winter of 1989, just a year after Willie was convicted. Albert Lindsay Turner was arrested on September 24, 2012, not for the rape of Carrie Elliott, but for the rape of the 12-year-old girl from 1973 in which they had a DNA match. He died in 2016 before he could be brought to trial for the rape of Carrie Elliott. After Willie's release, he said something that just tears at my heart. He said, "I had to cry to hold myself together." This man suffered for 24 years. Walking out of the courtroom that day was almost too overwhelming after what all he had been through, and there was no shame in his tears. And after all that, he still was not bitter, again crediting his faith in Jehovah that allowed him to forgive and forget. But his lawyer did convince him to sue the city, to set an example so maybe this terrible history of railroading black men would finally come to an end. Willie Grimes won a $3 million lawsuit against the city of Hickory, North Carolina. He would also be compensated $50,000 a year for 15 years after his release by the state of North Carolina. But there are still 18 states that offer no compensation for wrongful convictions. However, money means very little to Mr. Grimes. After all, he lost his mother and 5 siblings while he was incarcerated. He lost his chance at marriage with Brenda. He lost the best part of his life. But now, at least he is free. He lives in Lawndale, North Carolina, and sees his surviving sister almost every day. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps. If you're interested in supporting the show, come check out my Patreon page or my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. I also have a merchandise store open at whatamaneuver.net. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the Willie Grimes case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my main Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.